Très bien. Donc c'est un peu désagréable. Mais voilà, voilà, Étienne est rentré à nouveau normalement.
Je suis là, je suis là.
Très bien. Très bien. Voilà.
Okay, shall I start again?
Ouais, tout le monde nous a rejoint. Tu vois l'écran correctement? Je vais
Oui.
le mettre en full screen. Et puis de, oui, et tu vas pouvoir démarrer, oui. OK.
Okay, so there are many of those systems where, although there is a single good decision to make, there's a lot of uncertainty. Another example I have here is breast cancer screening. Now, it's still a real world experience of our think tank. We have a founder of a company, a listed company in France, who has designed a disrupting early screening of breast cancer through AI. And of course, now breast cancer is responsible for thousands of deaths and every year in a country like France. I don't know the statistics in Turkey. And in many cases, if you were able to screen a breast cancer early enough, before cancer go into metastasis, you can actually have a proper treatment. So you can save lives. And so there's a great stake for the common good in designing early screening of breast cancer. Now, of course, we're dealing here with a very uncertain system, which is the human body of the woman. Now, if you have a diagnosis at a few years ahead of the cancer, of course, you can understand that there's the complex phenomenology of the human being and the retraction with the uncertain environment, the way that that person will do sport, will eat, will get radiation from the external environment, will change the dynamics of the system. So there's a lot of uncertainty between the diagnosis at one date and what will happen 3 years later. However, and that's the nice thing about for the common good is you can still, with factors of risk, you can still give some probabilistic reasoning, helping to actually prioritize those women who might have more cancer than others, and so treat them earlier. And then, of course, many of those algorithmic services that we're using every day, including cultural recommendations, movies online, YouTube, whatever, social networks that are based, of course, as you know, on a recommendation system. Now, those recommendation system have multiple outcomes and very uncertain features. So there is not one good decision to make with a cultural recommendation. There are many movies that could suit you, many people that you could meet through a social network. This is a multivariate decisional problem, and it's also a problem, of course, highly uncertain because we are not able to profile in a true and honest and comprehensive way your preferences. So here we have a lot of uncertainty. Now, if you take the point of view of the free will, those are good news because if you have a high level of undetermination, then there's a high space for liberty. At least if you are able to actually act upon that free will. But there is no fatality in the face of those services. There is no fatality that the machine will know before you know what you need in the case of multiple outcome and very uncertain features. Next slide.
Is it this one?
Yeah, so right. So now we are clear with the benefits. We have challenged enough the data scientists in order to be confident in some amount of predictability and some amount of reliability of the algorithm. Then the issue is how explainable is this algorithm? And this issue attracts a lot of research now and knowledge research. There are also regulatory requirements, at least in Europe, in France and Europe, for a certain type of garden, for example, in France, since for about 5 years, administrative decision making supported by algorithm have to provide explanation of decision. This is written in law. Doesn't mean that it works, but at least by law, you have to provide explanations. And it's also the case to a certain extent under the European regulation. You have to a certain amount of decision to certain, you have to provide explanation. Now, of course, it's desirable if you pursue the common good, keeping in mind what we said of the common good on the point of view of the social doctrine of the church, for example, if you want to share the search for the common good with all the human beings, you want to increase confidence in decision-making and you want to share things. So you want to give an amount of explainability in the sense of letting algorithm being intelligible for those people who will be affected by the algorithm. Now, of course, explainability or explicability is not transparency. Is not just getting the millions or tens of millions. Previous slide, please. Is not getting the millions of lines or 10 millions of lines, 100 millions of lines of code of the search algorithm of Google that will help you to understand that algorithm. So it's not transparency. Or not, to some extent, there's a bit of transparency inside explainability, but as a big issue, it's not transparency. Now, how could you render explicable, explainable an algorithmic process? Now, the issue is, of course, not so easy. When you have a complex system, although you could explain with traditional science, for instance, you could go into atomic explanation of the Boltzmann law of diffusion. Now, even if you understand the instrumental explication of every single microcosmic amount of decision, you will get lost once the system is complex. So it's more into an overall understanding, and a big trend is marginal sensitivity analysis, shapely values. Some of you may be familiar with those, which comes from the old issue of sensitivity analysis, which is an old sector of applied mathematics, which has gone back into research recently under explainable AI. Meaning, for example, if I have a credit scoring, how will my score change if I change the place where I live, or if I change my job, or if I get older, or if I get more healthy? Explain me how the score will change. And in the United States, for example, credit scoring has been regulated for a number of years, and you have to provide three reasons explaining why the credit scoring is bad for you. So it goes into marginal sensitivity, right? Is a few percentage of changing in this feature, what is the consequences on the change of the Y, right? Now, of course, this marginal sensitivity has a lot of limitations, meaning that the sensitivity may only be local, of course, and the derivatives, because it's at the end of the day, it's about derivatives of y with respect to the x's may change a lot if you move just slightly in space. So then, how reasonable is it to give just a local sensitivity of the score? Now, other approaches are more into the spirit of nearest neighbors, is show me the kind of people that have the same score as I have. And for example, breast cancer screening is, you can usefully enrich the decision between doctor and patient, showing to the particular woman, now look, you are just like those people And among those people, there are that many red and that many blue. And so you can visualize the people who have had a similar score, and that maybe help you to understand why I'm actually advising you to follow this treatment. And then it's not a linear thing. It's more of a local nearest neighbor, a local non-parametric method. And of course, in some cases, there's this traditional debate between should I have a more precise algorithm with being less explainable, or should I have a less precise algorithm being more explainable? Now, my point of view of a practitioner is that maybe that debate has been overstated, because in real world application, it's very frequent that a slightly less precise algorithm is much easier to understand. And very often, when you have a big neural network thing, you can do almost as well with a logistic regression or with a simple decision tree. Once you've well understood why the neural network works, then it's easier to set a simpler model, which is going to be much more explicable. Now, on top of that practitioner argument, I will add a mathematical argument, meaning that if we go back to the generalization error we've seen in the previous slides, the curse of dimensionality leads you into understanding that if you have a complex model, that you have very high limitation on the estimation of the generalization error, meaning that you may, at the face of it, you may have the impression that a deep learning model is going to be really more precise than your simpler model. However, that precision is actually not true. Is a precision which is set on a validation sample, but that is not generalizable, or at least for which the proof of generalizability are very low because of the fate of the curse of dimensionality. So there is an additional argument for explainable simple models is actually robustness, of course. And it's much easier, and you could actually derive some strong probabilistic results on low dimensional simple model, and you cannot do it so for big models. Right. So next slide. So now I have an explainable model. And the question, of course, is all a question about autonomy, freedom of conscience, consent, rights. So do we get the consent of the people to actually use that algorithm for decision making? And do we get consent, not just click here and you're okay to share your data? Do you give me the consent now that you know the limitation of the algorithm, now that you know the biases? Do you consent on the trade-off between precision and explainability? Do you give your consent on the consent between negative, false negative, and false positive? So going into comprehensive consent, which is, of course, which is much more requiring than just clicking your consent on sharing your data. And of course, the question here is autonomy of the personal being, is respecting autonomy. And there's a lot of literature here, particularly on medical, on the medical tools. And the other side of the mirror is that you also have to strike the good compromise between sacrifice for the common good and personal freedom. And this is, of course, the case for vaccination, meaning to what extent is it reasonable for the common good to allow anyone to obstruct vaccination because he does not give his consent of vaccination, because that particular patient says, I'm not happy with the benefit risk. And here we have, of course, an ethical decision, which is not easy. And if I pursue the anthropology of the Bible, then there is this preference for the poor. And the preference for the poor means that in some situation, you're called into sacrificing your own good for the good of the poorest. And you're called into, you know, giving for your poor brother. And meaning that here the compromise between the benefit and the risk should also be shared into fraternity and the logic of sacrifice. And this is, of course, difficult. This is difficult. Of course, there's another issue of competition here, is the rise of monopolies I've been talking about in the early slides. And the fact that giving your consent on a particular sharing of data and particular sharing of algorithm should not also risk the increase of monopolies. And for instance, we all know the amount of Facebook accounts and WhatsApp, etc. And to what extent I have also the freedom to actually resist the choice of an algorithm, in spite of the fact that it could be more performing for my particular goods in the short term, because in the long term, it will increase the monopoly of Facebook. And to what extent I can also strike the trade between benefit and risk with regards of the risk of increasing monopolies. And to what extent I also increase the possibility of people to choosing between those services. And that's about also regulating monopolies inside your browser, inside the machine learning tools, etc., etc. And that's a big issue for promoting entrepreneurial competition, of course, serving the common good. Next slide. Justice. Now, justice, discrimination, biases. Now, this has attracting a lot of attention, of course, and you will all know about those scandals in the United States, algorithm for judging who should be freed from jail and who should not, because they will go into recidivist criminals. And are we fair between the black and the white people? And do we have biases between men and women? And do we have biases according to your origin, et cetera, et cetera? And here there's a question of what particular set of justice are you referring to? And of course, you have different justice. You have the contractual justice. Am I fair play with respect to a contract? Or you have distributive justice, I may not be fair respect to the contracts, but I'm fair with respect to the poor, meaning I'm into positive discrimination with respect to the most vulnerable people. Meaning that here algorithm, of course, could be tuned in a different way. And there's a sort of mistake. People say algorithms are biased. And the true question may not be, are they biased? The true question, because you can have a perfectly unbiased algorithm with respect to the data set, but then the data set may also be unbiased with respect to the present population. However, the question is not, is it biased? Is it, are we pursuing a desirable level of justice? And the question would be more, are we wanting to bias the algorithm with respect to the more vulnerable people? It's not debiasing, because no, there's no such debiased algorithm. There are algorithms which are tuned to represent a particular statistical distribution. And there are those statistical distributions representing a certain empirical reality of the world. So the question is more, are we wanting to bias with respect to more vulnerable people? And then the debate is about who are those vulnerable people? Is it more important that we encourage women to go to better jobs, or black people to get to better credits, even if the objective economical situation is less favored today, and onto a contractual reasoning, they have no higher right than other equally poor white people to get access to credit. But are we wanting to pursue a particular justice where we favor more? And do we favor more black people? Do we favor more women? Do we favor more handicapped people? Who are the poor? And there is a biblical, way to identify the poor. And the poor is le prochain in French. I don't remember the word in English. It's your nearest, maybe your nearest. Now, who is your nearest? And there are a lot of biblical stories into the nearest. Is your nearest, is a person of your tribe? Is it the person of the other tribe? Is it the person who is, is it the widow? Is it, who is the nearest? And that's an ethical question for every one of us. Is who is the nearest we want to favor? And there's not just one answer here, of course. And one of the principle here also, maybe, and that's also coming from the Bible, is the principle of subsidiarity. Now, the principle of subsidiarity is devolve to those people who are affected by the decision the choice to parameter the decision, meaning that do not impose the justice from the top, but outsource the choice for the justice model nearest to the people, and never pre-parameterize the algorithm before the people, and let the user be allowed to parameterize their own algorithm. And that may have a strong impact on the way design thinking is made, is encourage people to actually change the parameter of the machine learning. And even though people who are not digital experts facilitate for them the choices to parameter the algorithm and empower participation of the people in those algorithms. And next slide. The question then is, okay, we have all those algorithms now. They're explainable. They're performing. People have given their consent. We have encouraged the kind of justice we want. And this has been participative. And then the question is, how does the new jobs, the new service, what place is given to the human encounter? Now we may have a perfectly participative, just, desirable algorithm. Now, if that algorithm is going to put the doctors unemployed, is it a desirable society we have? And put the other way around, to what extent automation is desirable? And to what extent we want to strike an equilibrium between man-machine? And for example, in accounting, I had that experience in accounting. Actually, when I was developing that startup for automating automation, for accounting. One weekend, I played jazz with my friend Francis Rousseau. And there came the drummer. And the drummer, his wife is accountant. And the wife came to meet me and say, "Hi, Tim, how are you doing? What are you doing now? What's your job?" And I told her the story about automatic accounting. And she looked me into my eyes and said, "You'll find my job. You'll find my job." And that was a big crisis for myself. I told me, what am I doing with my wife? What am I doing? I'm finding the job of my friend, the wife of my friend, the wife of my good friend in jazz. What am I doing? And then I had the opportunity as an entrepreneur to actually change a bit the venture. And we went into more accounting decision support. And we went more into how can we, with accountants, how can we devise decision support tool that automates, of course, the low value repetitive task and help them be better accountants and help them scribe a better service for a better human relationship with the company they're serving. And of course, it's not so easy because it's not so easy to strike the difference between those low value repetitive tasks and those high value tasks that you want to keep for the accountant. It's not so easy because you become a good accountant when you're faced with a lot of repetitive tasks. And if you don't classify yourself the transaction. The bank transaction, you lose the touch with the data, and then you lose an understanding of the algorithm. So you have to keep some form of non-automated basic tasks in order to keep people competent with the high task. And that's not so easy, of course, because the business model to be stricken is easier if you automate everything and you license the thing and it's cheaper. Than just having people get use of it and getting the good balance. It's not so easy. It's not so easy, but it's much more interesting. It's much more interesting, and it's much more motivating. So here the bet is that those ventures, those algorithmic ventures, that will help people to change their job in a smart way. Without losing competence, my bet is that those ventures should succeed. Of course, it's an uncertain bet. Now, if you go into medicine, of course, there's a lot of scope for partially automated tasks, because what I've said about observability before. Is a strong limitation to algorithm. And we all know that the good doctor, the good family doctor, is that doctor who has enough experience to ask the right questions when they meet you. They're not just getting the raw data about you. They're not just getting the result of the RMM MRI or the radio images. They're not just getting data about your body. They're also reading in your eyes what's happening about you. They're also discussing you about non-observable features regarding your life. And we know some people say that Oriental medicine, traditional medicine, are much about the relationship between the doctor and the patient, and those non-observable, non-objective features help a lot into striking a good decision for medical prescriptions, of course, and also of course, it's not the same thing when you commit yourself as a patient. in front of a doctor who is also a coach for you, and you're engaging a sort of a moral relationship, meaning I am going to strike against my disease. And that's very different if, you, if you're facing the garden. And the garden without a common self, without a human brother, you're not getting the same kind of engagement that you will do your best to actually combat the cancer. So of course, there's a lot of other dimensions that could find their way into non-automated, or partially automated, augmented intelligence, of course, not just artificial intelligence. Let me do the last of my slide because I'm getting close to the end of my time. And the seventh stage is man doesn't live only on scores, right? And we all know with the pandemics that we're getting mad in being in front of screens everywhere. And of course, we're not wanting a world where everything is quantified, where everything is virtualized. And we also want not to go into a world of quantitative totalitarianism. And so we also want to go into a sort of a sober, automated world. Just like sobriety has a particular calling now in terms of ecology, and we're looking more now into a sober style of living, we also want a sober style of digital world, and we also want to resist a world into which there's the risk of anthropomorphism, right? We don't want to go into the world where chatbots are getting so much of a personal being that we are actually encouraging a world which is not really human. And so there's a calling here for resisting those kind of man-human, man-machine interface that are going too much into the deceptive side of an algorithm. You know, an algorithm is an algorithm, it's not a personal being. And we don't want to be overstating the Turing test if we want they're going to serve and not to enslave the human being. So maybe as a last slide, I move further. Next slide. So I've set a lot of the theoretical expectation, and not all of what I've done here is feasible in the real world, not always desirable. Next slide. And ethics is all about striking the right compromises between performance and explainability. I've already discussed that, between the level of justice and non-discretive justice, and then the contractual equity. If we go too much into biasing government in favor of the poor, then government may become unfair because you have the moral area, which is well known to insurers. Is if you give everything to people who've not deserved it in a contractual way, you're not encouraging people to get ready and fight for their own life. And there's also the compromise between intimacy and performance. If you're resisting the sharing of data, then you're going to be less performing, of course. You cannot have such a precise algorithm if you're not sharing to a certain extent your personal data. And so there's a compromise here, and there's a compromise also between security, efficiency, et cetera. Many sort of compromises that have to be stricken. And next slide. Of course, the compromises have not the same risk according to the situation. And we have situations where algorithms have lead to moderate risk, and those algorithms where have a high risk. And this kind of level of risk accompanied AI application is referred to in the new European, newly coming European regulations. And the new coming regulation is since on high risk AI, of course, where a lot of scrutiny has to take place, whereas it's less important for let's say moderate risk. Advertising display, for instance, if the advertising display is not so performing, is it so Is it so great? Is it so serious? If the weather forecast is not perfectly true and not perfectly explainable, who cares to a certain extent? And that's also maybe if you more into IT features, if you're into open exploration with the use of AI, or if you're going into forecast or predictive algorithm in law, meaning that you're exhibiting the uncertainty and not you're not just giving a point forecast, it's less risky. Now it's more risky if you just if you ignore uncertainty, you're going to a point forecast algorithm, and it's even of course more risky if you go into a really autonomous agent, whereby the agent itself handles uncertainty, and you're delegating the handling of uncertainty into a closed loop without human, then the risk is also going to be higher, and you have to have a more scrutiny. Next slide. And then at the end of the day, when you have those kind of compromises to strive for the common goods, there's also the question of which kind of ethics will help you to strike the risk benefit. And there are different ethics, and I don't have time to go into the details. It would require a new conference. And of course, many people in the AI world like this kind of utilitarian ethics, you know, expected utility, brought forward by Benham, for instance, and John von Neumann, and many others. And now utility ethics is very desirable for mathematicians or computer scientists, because you can compute utility, you can model utility, and you can compute a utility expectation optimization. So it's a very calculation-based ethics. Now, of course, a limitation is that you have to model sacrifice, right? When you're striking the highest utility, you have to say, you know, if the sum of utility is optimized, meaning that the sacrifice of people is equivalent to the good of others, and to what extent the sacrifice of the good of some people is equivalent to the goods of others, and so the logics of sacrifice is hidden inside the utility, the maximal utility. And so then you have the deontological ethics, and Immanuel Kant, for example, is one of the big reference head there. There are many others. And when you go into deontological ethics,